Hello, I'm Kerry Lunigan. Welcome to the Weekly Grill. It's brought to you by Beef Central and Elanco Animal Health. Today's guest has a remarkable all-round background of involvement and achievement in Australia's beef industry. David Foote has been at the pointy end of the remarkable growth of Australian Country Choice, a family-owned company with about 1.5 million hectares of land, turning off around 200,000 cattle a year, 3 feedlots and abattoir, and exported to 20 countries and for several years the major supplier of beef to Coles. David Foote, welcome to the grill.
Morning, Kerry. Thank you.
You're invited to a barbecue. The host says he or she will cook the steaks and cook them medium rare. What do you say?
I'm probably more known to, I'll cook the steaks for everybody, thank you, and they will all be medium rare.
So you want to be in charge of your barbecue and somebody else's barbecue as well, do you?
Generally known for that.
I'm not surprised. Now, let's start your career in high school in South Australia, I understand? You were born...
Yes, Kerry, yeah. Born at the edge of the Flinders Ranges and finished schooling like every small town boy back in the city of Adelaide.
And you ended up working for some pretty... big operators in your early days, Stanbroke, for example?
Well, lucky enough, goes back probably to the McBride family in South Australia, then on to a former Prime Minister, then quite a stint with the Meyer family in Southern Australia before coming to Queensland with Stanbroke.
And you saw the light to come to Queensland, did you?
I saw the invitation, Kerry.
Now, Stanbroke, how long were you there?
5 years.
It would have been a challenge working for a big operator like that. What was your involvement?
Well, it was different coming from private to corporate, but obviously the scale and the opportunity at Stanbroke to help lead them from being a northern cattle producer into a branded beef producer and a live exporter with a new feedlot was the exciting challenge.
And you left there not under a cloud, by far from it. In fact, there were ructions in the whole industry then when Stanbroke was broken up and sold.
Yeah, well, I left before the sale, but there had been a change in management at AMP that I guess forecast which way AMP's investment committee was looking at long-hold pastoral assets, and took the opportunity to join Kilcoy as CEO to look after their meat operations during that phase.
They were an up-and-coming company then, weren't they, Kilcoy?
Well, actually more than up-and-coming, actually old and boring and established. They were actually the first chilled beef exporter to Japan. They had a really, really long history of focusing just on that Japanese market, including they had their office in Japan.
So after a few years there, you were headhunted once again by Trevor Lee from Australian Country Choice. I think most then would have seen Australian Country Choice as a company with potential. What did it actually consist of in those days, the late 1990s?
Yeah, well, Kerry, it was. I suppose it's a story that I don't mind telling. So I'd got to know Trevor and ACC through the Stanbroke era because Stanbroke actually was ACC's largest cattle supplier. For years prior to Stanbroke building Bottle Tree Feedlot, Stanbroke had fed its cattle through the Brisbane Valley Feedlot and was, as I think, single largest supplier into ACC. So I'd known Trevor for a while. Had been working through with Trevor, thinking about getting a kill at Kilcoy for ACC, because at that stage they were still just tenants at the Cannon Hill Works. Trevor, during that process, Trevor actually invited me to his house one evening, which was a bit of a surprise. I hadn't been before and got to sit down. He said, "I'd just like to show you a presentation." And he rolled out before me his 10-year plan for ACC. And... which encompassed growth in feedlots, properties, etc., in the supply chain. And he said, "What do you reckon?" I said, "Oh, looks pretty good." He said, "Well, I've got the Coles MD coming up tomorrow. I want him to tell you that you're coming to run it." So that was a bit of a take a breath away moment. I was happily into 2 years into the Kilcoy job during a turnaround. And, but overnight needed to make a decision. Trevor was very generous. He said, "Mate, it's up to you. There's a seat on the train. The train leaves tomorrow. I'm not sure there'll be one if you're not on it." So I had to make some decisions that night and talk with the Kilcoy board. And I guess, 21 years later, I'm still here.
Wow. And you've seen and been part of that extraordinary growth of the company.
Yeah, I mean, being inside, it's sometimes hard to reflect on how fast you've grown or what you've done. But just on the numbers, I mean, when I joined... including our boning room operations, we had 110 staff, 6,000 cattle on feed, and two cattle properties, Brindley Park and Babalora. And I think today we sit here, we've got three feedlots, 1,400 staff, 34 cattle operations. And, yeah, so it's significantly a bigger business.
Absolutely. Now, one of the key factors was, of course, getting the Coles contract. They were pretty good customers right from the word go, weren't they?
Coles, well, the one Trevor identified very early in his career, back in 1972, that you needed a customer for your production system. And so we journeyed with Coles the whole way through to sell them the vertical integration, the opportunity of control of the animal from birth through to slaughter, just in knowing true cost. And so it was a partnered through a relationship. Coles never had any ownership part in ACC, and we reflected through and we grew. And grew the back end to overcome, I guess, the vagaries of supply and the consistency of supply. And just piece by piece, there was rapid growth in early 2001, then some lulls, and then just slow, steady growth thereafter, to where, I guess, by 2014-15, we were nearly producing 80% of Coles' national beef requirements.
Wow, that's a lot of beef. One of the key decisions that was made was to sell meat without HGPs.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, following Wesfarmers' takeover of Coles and the introduction of a serious number of UK retail executives who come from very much of a clean food background, or what they call it, a clean food background, and hormones weren't known to them, that one of the few things left, and Coles weren't the first. I mean, Woolworths have actually had, during that period, under their livestock buying team, a strong preferredness to not have HGPs, but it was never stated or never a claim, because you just couldn't get over the line if you don't control the supply chain. And so from a Coles point of view, the question was, can we? Now, Coles had been asking ACC about HGP-free beef for 10 years prior to the change in management. And we're always managing and able to say, yes, of course we can, but this would be the cost of such a program in terms of the efficiencies, the rollout across. This is the first time, so having had a meeting in Melbourne with the director at the time, who suggested, what about HGP-free? Can we go hormone-free? They didn't know what an HGP was. They just called it hormones. And I said, yes, but it will cost X. And he looked across the table at me and he said, well, I've got the X. So I come back home and I said to Trevor, and the fellow said, I think we're in trouble. He said he's got the money. So we therefore had to start a program. And that program, I guess, worked undercover for nearly 2 years, with all our suppliers that were called middle circle suppliers, and the families, going into a trial to measure the impact on productivity, because it was Coles' full intent, and they did at the time, they actually compensated, or wrong word, but they paid for that reduced efficiencies that we had shown through the trials of
using it. What was it, David, about 16%?
We actually measured it at 12, Kerry. Well, it's actually quite interesting. When you go across the data we use, we actually had some cattle perform better without than within, so the variation was quite astronomical, but we settled on it on 12%, and that's what was effectively reflected into the first grid for those prices. We'd set up for March 2011 launch, but typical of retailers looking for an opportunity, we got the call in about October that we'd actually like to launch on Boxing Day. So things had to happen in a hurry. We had to empty not only the supply chain of cattle out, but actually the supply chain of meat in freezers, et cetera, everywhere, to ensure there was no leakage at all into the system. So it was a major thing, and Coles probably have celebrated, and with ACC, the fact that it was such a major shift in a supply chain program that they managed to roll out across all their stores.
It certainly was a major shift, dropping that 12% in productivity, an amazing task set to you to make it all work.
Well, I think the important thing was, instead of just coming out and making an edict of we will, it was please let us understand what the cost of that change would be. And so I think, yes, today it's probably evaporated into that's part of the norm, but at the time the prices were all kicked to our supply chain to reflect that cost of production.
Okay, let's jump ahead now to what I've been told was one of the most significant speeches made at the recent Beef Australia conference in Rocky, and for which you were loudly applauded. You threw out several challenges to those present, the leaders of the beef industry. It was so different, and I, for one, was not surprised. Is this because you always seem to look beyond the obvious, that is, look outside the square with various problems that confront you?
Well, I think your comment there is a bit generous. I think it was first night. There's still a bit of first night fever, hence the applause.
And the Prime Minister was there as well?
Well, the Prime Minister was there, which actually caused a couple of late changes to the speeches and presentations that probably being known for wanting to throw a few extra challenges or throw a few, I didn't think it was the forum to highlight any shortcomings in the industry in front of the Prime Minister when we're trying to encourage the industry.
Like costs, et cetera.
So, well, not just costs, about how we may be able to perform better in some of our systems and our integrity systems and what we're doing. So I had to, I guess, reluctantly soften it a little bit because we didn't want the Prime Minister having a message that we were confused.
Well, I wonder if he understood what you're talking about when you talk about branding rates in the North and the South.
Hopefully he won't. He'll think the brands are something else, but from a productivity point of view, and I guess it's part of having the factory, not background, but constantly in mind, is it's all about efficiencies. Productivity is all about efficiency. If you're running 1,000 cows and only producing 700 calves, you're still feeding, managing, growing, and owning enough land for the 300 that aren't producing. So to whittle away and just get some performance out of those 300 that aren't producing is a key, or just a lost opportunity. Now, it's never going to be 100%. But our cousins in the South are doing 80%, and we're doing 70%, so it's got to be there. And what's the difference between the North and the South? Well, there's some breed impact, there's certainly some seasonal impact, and there's definitely some nutritional impact.
Nutritional impact, you say?
Well, I think it's still all about getting your cow back in calf, because obviously calf at the start of the wet season up there, getting back in calf during, and obviously it's the stress of fertility through the calving process. So it's just about getting you, improving the nutrition to get your cow cycling again.
With respect, those operators in the North are some big, big companies up there and some wise men running them or wise people running them. They would have looked at this surely and tried to do what you suggest.
I think everybody's tried for lots. Everybody's known it for lots, and phosphorus was a key. Trying to learn how to get phosphorus into your cattle has been a challenge. It's not the most palatable supplement, but it's also about cost and also about getting out across all your cows in those areas. And recent programs, which there's still quite a bit of debate about whether, it's about segregating your cows into your calving groups so that you're only feeding those cows that are in one stage of calving or pregnancy. So it's about managing your herd differently, and I guess managing your herd more intensively on a very extensive operation.
Is there anything in the theory that maybe some of those young heifers are being joined too young?
Puberty is all about weight rather than age. And so I guess it hasn't happened for a while, Kerry, because the seasons haven't been in favour of most in the West or the North. But it's not uncommon in great seasons for calves on cows to become pregnant because they've actually reached puberty and cycling, which is just an indicator of nutrition.
So how can the producers across the North say, I give you a big property and 60,000 cattle to increase their efficiency, and there's 30,000 heifers and cows there. How do you start that?
I guess, well, my first recipe will be only use measured bulls. So know the productivity of your bulls first up. Have them semen tested, or actually more importantly, morphology tested to see if they're active to be managed. You're asking them to do a lot. Not only got to walk great distances, they've also got a job to do with hopefully 30 to 40 cows each. So get your bulls sorted. Use measured bulls with EBVs or some form of data management system that will indicate their performance. Then from your cow's point of view, if she didn't get in calf, get rid of her. History's been from schoolboy age, the late calver will breed a late calver. So it's highly heritable genetics. So it's just a matter of tighten your herd up, just keep productive cows. Don't come up with an excuse for why a cow wasn't productive.
Let's take a short break now to hear a message from our podcast partner, Elanco Animal Health.
Acatac Duo Star from Elanco provides knockdown and residual control of cattle ticks and ivermectin-sensitive parasites. Applied early in the season, Acatac Duo Star reduces the buildup of the tick population and helps to prolong the life of effective chemistry. Give ticks and worms the flick with Acatac Duo Star. Always read and follow the label directions and ensure good agricultural practice for optimal parasite control.
Welcome back. I'm speaking on the grill with David Foote, recently retired as Chief Executive Officer of Australian Country Choice and currently Director of Industrial and Corporate Affairs at Australian Country Choice. In your Rocky speech, you also used terms like research and development, innovation, and out of that you get survival, or if you do it well, you get success. It sounds easy, or it sounds good and it sounds easy.
Oh, no, it sounds fantastic, and that's what you're allowed to do when you give a speech at Rockhampton once every 3 years. But it was in the context of, the Rockhampton speech was in the context of what's changed from my first visit in 1997 to this year in 2021. And it really was about technology and those companies or those systems that weren't on the showgrounds or were on the showgrounds in 1997 that aren't there today. And in technology-wise, it was actually really interesting to learn up as to, of the four telephone companies that had mobile phones at Rockhampton 1997, none exist today. They've either been sold or they're actually obsolete. And that's the same with computers, sold or obsolete. So those companies that have done all the R&D, the innovation, were the ones that are on the showgrounds today. So, and if you think about that, and mine was more in the context of the chicken industry effectively hasn't had a price rise for 20 years, but nobody's gone out of business in chicken. It's still growing from, I think, consumption rates of 18 kilos per capita to 56 or 58 today without a price rise. How's the chicken industry done it? Genetics and feed efficiency. Otherwise, they couldn't stay in business. So there's no reason, which I thought, therefore, innovate, R&D and innovate.
So it's all about change. Do you think Australian farmers and grazies are willing to adopt change as well as other people or other industries?
The easy answer is if you have a look across at the ag tech that's available, you'd think yes. But when you come back and really drill down inside ag, and this was part of the story in Rockhampton, is to get major change in the Australian beef industry, I think I might have described it, there are four stages. The first one for change is, if it's imposed on you, is disbelief as to somebody would therefore ask you to dare you to do that. The second phase is we'll fight it and resist it. The third phase is, well, let's look at it and see if we can work for it. And the last phase is, oh, we'll have to do it, so we'll do it. So that process generally seems to take about 2 years. Incredible amount of time, incredible amount of energy, and you end up with what you started with at the start. And I put that into the context, really, of things like the NLS system or the LPA system or the NVD system, all the things that are just asking to give a warranty on our animals or the product that we produce, which is not unreasonable, but they're not given in easy. So, yeah.
NLIS attracted a lot of opposition, didn't it? Now it's the envy of the beef world around the world.
Yeah, and I'll put my hand up. We're also an early objector, mainly because of the single type of technology or provider that was chosen. But once you get past the, well, what else can we use it for? And the minute you can start to use it for electronic data management, then LIS become actually an adjunct to your business.
Yeah. Moving now to land use, are we optimising our land use in Australia? Question which arises quite a bit when I sit down and talk to people in the industry.
When you say optimising, I'm a bit uncertain in the context of that of have we developed our lands to the extent that we could? Clearly in Queensland that's struggled since the land vegetation management laws have come in under various Labor governments. And so, therefore, we can surely convert and or develop timber into grazing land or into food production much more successfully. I think certainly as you get further south, then clearly there's been much more development because they haven't had to overcome. They have vegetation management laws. They cleared the land before they came in. So I think, yes, there's still more to do. I really don't think that agriculture has been given worthwhile access to water storages, water reserves to develop agriculture and food production. Yes, the Great Artesian is famous. It's been in our geography books since primary school. I'm just not sure we need one of the world's largest underground water storages that we don't get to access. So I think we just need to work out how do we manage that resource better and convert it into food or fibre.
What's your view on the current property price boom that seems to be endless around Australia?
Yeah, well, Kerry, it's about like me asking to forecast livestock prices. I used to think I was pretty good at it, and now I haven't got a clue. There's a glass ceiling. But it comes back to my old model used to be a bit like public companies, price earnings. So you keep a cow for, say, 10, 11 years. Ideally, if you're in the north, you might get 7 calves. Maybe in the south, you're going to get 8 calves out of that cow. So the lifetime earnings of that cow equals what I believe what the lifetime, what an AE should be worth. So let's just say 5 years ago, that calf was worth $5 say $500 a calf. So if it produced 7 calves, therefore that breeder value was worth $3,500. Today it's where it is. The minute you start paying past its lifetime earnings, I'm starting to wonder, I think you're starting into getting another realm, and I'm not sure what value that comes up with. And today, we're certainly heading into that space.
Yes, I had a claim made to me the other day that there's no property, rural property, been sold in Australia on a benefit of a reasonable return on investment.
Well, it depends what reasonable return on investment is. I mean, you could put your money in a cash management trust and earn 0.5%. Or you could put your cash into land, which will have an appreciation value, but it'll also have a productivity value. So I think, yeah, maybe the 10s, 12s, 14s, 15% are gone, but the alternative is either the stock market or in your bank.
I've got a couple of quick questions to finish, but here's one that may be not so fast. The age-old question, how does the industry unite, that is, producers and processors speak with the one voice, or almost the one voice? Because you can't, no one can sit here and say they're united because...
Oh, Kerry, I mean, and I have a leg in each camp, which sometimes make it awkward, so maybe it's barbed wire in between. But there is still a reluctance between the producing sector and the processing sector. And I've been trying to deal with it, understand it, work around it for 20 years. But I actually think that the producer sector is not yet united. I mean, we still run a grain-fed separate to a grass-fed sector. So even our beef is divided. Our agricultural entity is divided. Western Australia has 3 representative bodies for their farmers and graziers. So, I mean, we actually haven't even got the production sector together before we sit down and talk with the processing sector. But there's not many processors now that aren't involved in the production sector. I mean, very few of them don't own a feedlot. Very few of them don't own some land. So, part of that myth should have been broken down easily, but it's still not there.
Good points, but... Does this mean, of course, that an organisation like the MLA might have had its day and needs to be restructured?
The MLA is a research and development corporation. It's not about lobbying for producers. It's not allowed to. It's not within its charter or statutory agreement. So it can help in capability building participants or levy payers, but the reality is it's the organisations that are to represent the beef producers that need to come to terms and represent solely first.
Okay. Quick questions now. 3D meat and false name. Let's start with the false naming of plant-based products as meat.
Yeah, current topic, and totally disagree with being able to use meat for plant-based products.
And government should do something about it?
Government is going to look into doing something about it quite clearly under Senator Susan McDonald.
I think a lot of people hope something happens there. Now, 3D meat... Please explain what happens here.
Oh, well, actually, I was actually reviewing a video from Israel this morning of where they're using, it looked like plasticine, but they assured me it was blood. So that cuts out the vegans. And it was fat, so I'm not, that cuts out producing a steak-like product. But it looked far from interesting. But this 3D printer was producing 6 kilograms a day of steak. But, Kerry, I'm just wondering why.
Yeah, well,
there is no shortage. Australia will face no shortage. Let's just enjoy what we produce.
Now, when we have our next drought, not if it's a matter of when in Australia when we have a drought, and a lot of cattle come flooding onto the market, where do we get the labour from to operate the processing plants around Australia?
Well, hopefully the next drought will wait until COVID has finished and we'll go back into our labour schemes or our imported labour schemes. I mean, currently I know the Minister for Ag has announced the ASEAN labour scheme to mimic the Pacific labour scheme to bring in short-term workers to provide assistance, not just the meat processing, but the whole way through ag and horticulture. I don't think it will be a great problem because I don't see that flood of cattle carry happening for at least another 3 years.
Look, a lot more issues we could cover, but time's gotten away with us. One final question. You're a rugby union fan. I'm a rugby union fan. Final question. Can the Wallabies ever win at Eden Park?
I think I've actually made a public statement, unfortunately, is that is still only a possibility.
And remote, I would suggest. David Foote, a pleasure to have you on The Grill. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kerry. Great to be here.
And thank you for joining me today. Until next time, I'm Kerry Lonigan, and this is The Weekly Grill, brought to you by Beef Central and our podcast partner, Elanco Animal Health.